at unfetteredmind.org, you'll find transcripts of this podcast series, and these you can read or download free of charge. The transcripts are divided into small sections with audio clips. This makes it easy for you to listen to the specific passages that catch your interest. If services like these are useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind. Making Things Happen, Part 2.
Before we go on to Part 2, I'm just going to make a couple of comments. One of the things that would be good, and I should have mentioned this before the break, is in the blanks here, you might note what are the things that get in your way, which fall under willingness, which fall under capacity, which fall under know-how. That's going to give you a bit of a map about how to work with stuff. The second thing, I just want to tidy up a little bit. What does willingness look like? It's the things like confidence, courage, clarity. Know-how is skill building, training, capacity. We've discussed many of these. There's things like attention, intention, intelligence, people, time, money. These are all of the things. These are the kinds of things that would fall under capacity. Each of these three aspects are very addressable. Willingness can be developed. As Randy just pointed out to me during the break, willingness is primarily in the emotional arena. So in developing willingness, you're going to be working with emotional issues most of the time. I hesitate to say all the time because somebody always comes up with an exception. Know-how, this can be trained. You can learn. You can learn how to do things. That isn't simply intellectual because sometimes you have to get the body to learn how to do things, to move in certain ways for certain kinds of skills, like music and so forth. But know-how is something that you can learn. And capacity can be built or developed or grown, whichever way you want to look at it. But you cannot learn capacity. You can learn how to develop capacity, but then you have to develop it. You can't learn capacity. Okay? You can address all of the emotional issues that you want, but if you don't have the capacity to do what you want, it's not going to help you. So these are three distinct areas, each of which needs to be addressed in its own way. But that's very doable. It just it helps to keep it straight so we aren't confusing applying the way of addressing one to one of the other ones, because that's not going to work. Now, part two proper. What we're going to focus on in part two are the four foundations of success. Now, this is not worldly success. This is success in being able to make things happen, whatever you choose. Success, and when I've just used the phrase worldly success, is defined by the eight worldly concerns. Some of you are familiar with these. Happiness, unhappiness, gain, loss, fame, obscurity, respect and disdain. So that a person who is happy, wealthy, famous, and respected, we usually say this is a success. And a person who is unhappy, poor, obscure, and disdained, we usually say it's a failure. These are the criteria for success and failure that are defined by society. It's why we have the wonderful phrase in Buddhism, the winds of the eight worldly concerns. There's a lovely story from China about that, about the Chan master who went to see a professor who loudly proclaimed wherever he went that he was free from the winds of the eight worldly concerns. So he went to his residence, knocked on the door, he wasn't home, he went in, took out a piece of paper and wrote in exquisite calligraphy, we'll call the Professor Li is a fart, and left it on Professor Li's desk. Went back to his place, which was on the other side of the Yangtze River. Well, Professor Li arrived home, saw this, and could tell immediately who wrote it by the calligraphy. Stormed out of his house, went down to the Yangtze River, and rented a ferry, got across, stormed into the Chan master's house and said, waving the piece of paper, "How dare you write this? Don't you know who I am?" And the Chan master said, "Oh, yes, certainly. I've heard of Professor Li, the great Professor Li, who is free from the winds of the eight worldly concerns. But it seems he's been blown across the Yangtze River by a little puff of air." Success in the way that we're talking about here is simply the ability to implement your intention. In other words, to bring what you want to see happen into being. Now, this is very important from a spiritual point of view. My friend Stephen Batchelor gave a series of talks which are available on the web on the life of Buddha, which I found very, very illuminating and very enjoyable, and it's a complete demythification of the life of Buddha. But at the beginning of this, he talks about the series. He talks about the word meditation and what one is actually doing. The word in Sanskrit and Pali actually doesn't mean meditation at all, apparently. But it has the quality of bringing something into being. And then Stephen asks, well, what are we bringing into being? And he says, we're bringing our path of life into being. And I found this very helpful because from the Tibetan tradition, there's tremendous emphasis on path as a theme. And there is in all Buddhism, but it's really emphasized in Tibetan Buddhism. But it's often presented as in the path. And you're going to do this, and then this, and then this, and then this. This is completely contrary to my own experience, both in terms of my own practice, but also in terms of my work with students, because I had to throw out the traditional path because it really didn't work for me. And it doesn't work for most of the people I work with, and there may be a little bit of cause and effect in there, but we won't go into that. But we're very much bringing our path into being, our path through life, of which meditation is a way that we build the capacity to tread that path. So success from this point of view is very important for us, because are we successful in bringing that path or finding our path in life? And what is the characteristic of that path in life? It's what I was saying at the beginning. Is that it is, we find a way to live without struggle. This is what it means to put an end to suffering. And that has very important ramifications for us, but you know very well that when you are not struggling, then you are able to truly assist others in not struggling as well. But as long as one is struggling, one's not really that available to help others. So the ability to end suffering very much begins with ourselves, finding a way to live without struggle. And I don't mean just materially, I mean the whole catastrophe, all the internal stuff, etc. And then we have a huge capacity of free attention, which we can then bring to the benefit of others. So we're going to talk about and explore now the four foundations of success, which is on page 2 of the handouts. This I came across when I was reading a book by a very good Theravadan teacher who lives down in further south from here, Thanissaro Bhikkhu, or Than Jeff. Some of you probably know him. He writes prolifically, and he's, yes, I saw that, has a really, really deep mastery of the Theravadan literature, and is just able to bring all of the stuff together in ways which I think are just very, very good. So I recommend him. It's very traditional stuff, but there's a grounded common sense quality in all that he writes, and he's applies his understanding to the pricking of a number of illusions and sources of confusion that are very popular these days. So this comes from one of his writings, and no doubt he's got it from one or other of the Pali texts. So the four foundations are interest in understanding things. You're not going to be able to bring something into being if you aren't willing, this goes straight to willingness, of course, understand how things actually work. Because, to use a biblical analogy, otherwise you're going to be building a house on sand. an activity which I have a great deal of practical experience with. Secondly, persistence that continues after the exploration. A lot of us get terribly interested in something, and then we find out a certain amount about it, and then that's it. We don't actually take it to the next step where we learn it with enough detail and enough thoroughness to really know how to work in that arena. And that could be, you know, finance, it could be martial arts, it could be music, it can be painting, it can be project management, etc. And there's all any area of life, there's always interesting stuff. And really understanding how it works requires going a step deeper than just learning about it. One actually has to do something and work in it, because if you don't work in that particular milieu, you don't really understand. It's always from the outside. That leads to the third one, which is close attention to genesis and conditions. And that's one of the areas I want to focus on in this part too. And the second is creativity in framing questions, which is a huge topic, and I've only taken one particular approach. I hope you'll find it helpful. Now, as I was putting this together, I thought, you know, this is interesting. These correspond to another framework that I use more in connection with the power, which will be used working with in the spring retreat very explicitly. There are the four steps of standing up. You have to show up in the situation, otherwise you're not going to be able to stand up in it if you're not there. Then you have to open to what is. You serve what is true to the limit of your perception. We can't do any more than that. The limit of perception defines what we can know at a given moment of time. And then receive the result. Sometimes it goes the way that we thought it would, sometimes it doesn't, but whatever it is, we receive it and work from there. Well, in a certain sense, show up corresponds to interest in understanding things. Excuse me. Opening means that we're willing to go deeper and open to the fullness of the thing. That's the persistence that continues after the exploration. In order to be able to serve what is true, you're going to have to pay close attention to genesis and conditions. And this last one is a bit of a stretch, but creativity in framing questions. You've got to let go of assumptions if you're going to be creative. You've got to let go of how you're used to looking at things. And it's that quality of letting go of control that is characteristic of receiving the result. You're just, okay, this is what happened. Now, what do I do now? Rather than, how can I make it better for me? But right now, I want to focus very much on genesis and conditions. The key thing here is to distinguish between genesis and conditions. Now, those of you who've are familiar with karma, and as it's taught, usually taught in Buddhism, know very well that karma is usually described as cause and effect. This has always struck me as a very misleading, and now feel that it's a completely incorrect translation. It's why cause and effect, the way that we understand it in Western culture, I mean, the average person, not the philosopher, because the philosophers make everything more complicated, is you put your foot on the accelerator and the car goes faster. You put your foot on the brake and the car slows down, unless there's something wrong with your brakes. And then the wall slows you down very quickly. So there's that's what we mean by cause and effect. I do X, Y happens. Very important in science, establishing cause and effect is extremely important in terms of treating disease, for instance. And there's the age-old adage, correlation does not equal causation, which is a good thing to keep in mind. Just think, because two things occur together doesn't mean one causes the other. They both may come from something else. And this takes us into the area of genesis. Cause and genesis are very, very different. The increase in speed in the automobile is caused by my putting my foot on the accelerator. But the genesis of it is the increased amount of gas and oxygen going into the cylinders. So more stuff burns. So genesis refers to what things actually grow from. A easier way to think about genesis is an acorn. An acorn is the genesis of an oak tree. In English, we do not say that the acorn causes the oak tree. We would say, of course, it's a seed, but I'm looking for a more general term, so I mean, that's why I've chosen the term genesis, even though it's a wonderfully old-fashioned word. But a genesis by itself may or may not grow into a result. You take that acorn and you put it on the top of Half Dome in Yosemite, not a hell of a lot's going to happen. There's no soil. There may be water, but it just runs off. There isn't the right kind of shelter because it's getting blasted by the sun and frozen at night. The conditions aren't right. So in addition to genesis, we need to have the right conditions. Now, conditions are closer to what we call causes in ordinary English. And this is typical Buddhist logic in the way that we think about things in Buddhism. There are usually many causes. Again, Carol, could I borrow Wake Up to Your Life? I didn't know I was going to need this book so much. A friend of mine, a good friend of mine, when he first got the book, he didn't read anything except the Nasruddin stories. And then he sent me a note saying, I love your book. What is fate? Nasruddin was asked by a scholar. An endless succession of intertwined events, each influencing the other, That's hardly a satisfactory answer, said the scholar. I believe in cause and effect. See, right on topic. Very well, said the mullah. Look at that. He pointed to a procession passing in the street. That man is being taken to be hanged. Is that because someone gave him a silver piece and enabled him to buy the knife with which he committed the murder? Or because someone saw him do it? Or because nobody stopped him? So, in Buddhism, if I take a brick and I throw it at the window, thank you, and the window breaks, in Western thought, you'd say, well, Ken, you broke the window. And I would say, well, no, I practice Buddhism. That's not accurate. It was really the glassmaker who was the problem, because he did not make the glass thick enough. But also the brickmaker has something to do, because the brick was cooked too long and was too hard, and it didn't crumble upon impact. And actually, it's really the vitamin maker, because I had my vitamins this morning, and that caused me to throw it with all my strength. And if I didn't have that much strength, then I wouldn't have broken the window. There are many, many different factors or conditions, and everything is like that. So we have the genesis, which is what really things really grow out of, and then we have the conditions, which are necessary for that that thing to grow, but aren't the thing itself. So we go back to our acorn. It needs moisture in the ground, so it's the shell of the acorn softens, activates the genes, which then start doing their little number and starts absorbing the moisture and minerals from the soil. And it needs a certain amount of warmth so that the whole process doesn't just freeze in the process. And then it needs sunlight, which then starts turning the chlorophyll, the chlorophyll turns carbon dioxide and oxygen, and roots go down and extract minerals and all of this stuff. And after, 400 years, you have an oak tree. Doesn't happen overnight. So what I want us to do now is to break up into groups, and they can be the same or different, and you might as well take the opportunity to get to know more people here, so different groups. And we're going to use the same format, maybe not quite as rushed as we were, because we don't have quite so much to do here. And I want you to take one of the things that gets in your way. That's why I asked you to take notes. And talk about what's the genesis and what are the conditions. So you may want to take some time right now to think about that. What's the genesis of that problem? What are the conditions that allow it to flourish in your life? This is applying these four factors of success to our exercise, our work today. And the point of this is to give you a little practical experience in actually applying them. You'll be able to apply them elsewhere, but I would just want. And we're going to throw in the next bit, because I like to make this a rich thing, is creative questions. The other two people in your group are going to ask creative questions. So this will be a way for them to practice this. So if you turn again to your handouts, and I know this is a great deal all at once, that's why we're going to have a little more time. I thought, okay, now, how do you be creative in asking questions? Well, I have a mathematical background, and mathematics is all about solving problems. So one of the techniques for solving problems is, if you can't figure out how to do something, you try to figure out what would prevent that something from coming about. So when I ask myself, okay, how do you come up with creative questions? I ask myself, okay, what prevents creative questions or creativity from coming about? That one I could answer very easily. There are many things, but one of the ways is and again, this is something I'll be talking about in the Power Retreat, are the six forms of mind killing. Or you can say creativity killing. And we've been exposed to 8 years of this in this country, very powerfully. And they're listed at the bottom of the page, on page two. Marginalization, framing, seduction, alignment, reduction, and polarization. Let me explain each of these. Marginalization means saying, that's not important. It's put on the margin, and so it's not given attention. Now, I can't remember, I think it was either Schrödinger or Einstein said, the really important words in science are not eureka, but, huh, that's funny. Because there you've discovered something, now you explore it. So many people say, oh, that's funny. Oh, that's not important. They've missed the opportunity. And a very powerful form of argument is to dismiss the importance of what the other person is saying. So somebody says, well, X, Y, and Z, I need to consider those. You say those aren't important. We're paying attention to this. And now you've defined the frame, and what is important to them isn't even being considered. They've lost. Right there. It's a form of mind killing. What's important here is, how often do various voices in you say, that's not important? I mean, how many of you have got into relationships you've later regretted? Only one or two people. Wow. Okay. How many of you, when you look back, recognize the warning signs right at the beginning? And guess what you said? That's not important. Marginalization. So this is the way our patterns work on us internally as well. The second one is framing. Framing refers to framing the issue in such a way that the questions that you don't want asked can't be asked. That is, they just don't exist. So I referred earlier to the dominance of financial perspectives. In Harvard Business School, they refer to any emotional considerations as poetry. And so somebody gives an answer to a question, they say, well, he's being very poetic, isn't he? Bang, his stuff's gone. So the frame is that of money, and anything that doesn't fit into that has no value and can't even be talked about. That's an example. Now you can see how this kills creativity. Seduction. Seduction refers to the technique of saying, if you do this, all your dreams will be answered. Yeah. This is what is at the base of every cult. Again, it is a exploitation of your own aspirations, your own wishes, that the other person now takes over, saying, you're going to get exactly what you wanted if you do what I do, what I want you to do. But you never get that. You just get to do what they want you to do. And again, looking at our patterns. How many have run across to say, well, if you just do this, you'll get what you always wanted? Though it usually doesn't turn out that way. Next one is alignment. And that is the presentation of, you have to do this in order to survive. So it's different. It's not about the fulfillment of dreams. It's about this is what you're going to need to do in order to survive. You get this in law firms and medical school, etc., where a person says, or engineering school, I've come across it, or young engineers, things like saying, well, you know, this is what we learned in school. And the old guy says, if you want to survive in this business, you're just going to ignore that stuff and you're going to do it this way. And something dies in the person right there. How many times have your pattern said, if you do it any other way, you won't survive? You're recognizing these internal voices. These are all forms of mind killing. They kill the quality of attention you're trying to bring to your life. The last two are reduction and polarization. Reduction means to reduce everything to one emotionally charged issue, which is a great way of making sure nobody can think or pay attention. Back in the time of Caesar, and there was this, the Roman emperors did this, the Germans did this in the Nazi era, it was done with respect to the Iraq War. Inspire fear in the population, and they will go along with whatever you want. And so it's a very deliberate campaign to promote fear. And that's how all of the stuff was railroaded through in all three things, whether it's the Roman Empire, the Germans or the Nazis, leading up to the Second World War, or neocon administration. Polarization refers to polarizing the issue. So it's either this or that. And I remember having a discussion with a Republican friend of mine around the beginning of the Iraq War, and it was, well, do you want Saddam Hussein to stay in power or not? No, it's a little more complex than that. No, it isn't. That's it. And so it precludes any other possible discussion. It's a way of simplifying things. And if you can define that, then you've killed any other possibility. Now, whenever you find yourself internally engaged in either or thinking, it's either this or this, you're caught in exactly that one. That's polarization. It's very rarely the case. I had a very, back in about, it was 1987, there was a certain situation I was facing, and I was thinking in this either or situation, and a friend of mine just said, Ken, why don't we just take the idea that you're going to do both this and this? How would that come about? And it was just like, I don't know. But then we started to think about it, and we came up with a totally different approach to the situation. Because rather than taking the either or, which was polarity, is it this or this, put those two things together, and then you got all kinds of different ideas coming up. So in the creativity and questions, you'll come up with many more. I tried to come up with six questions. And these are just examples. These aren't things which are the opposite of these forms of mind killing. So instead of marginalization, what's not being considered, or what's operating in this situation that we don't consider as important? So that's one possible question. Okay, what are we not paying attention to here? So that means looking at the margins. It's the opposite of marginalization, where you're pushing things away. What are other ways of looking at this? So that's to shift the frame. How can we look at this differently? How many of you are familiar with drawing on the right side of the brain? Okay, so one of the exercises there is to turn things upside down. And now your usual way of looking at things can't operate, and you actually draw a better picture. The ordinary associations aren't getting in the way, or to draw it with your left hand, or something like that. For seduction, what assumptions are being made is one way. You may come up with other questions. go against it. For instance, seduction is about this is what you'll get what you want if you do this. Well, another thing is, are there other ways to get the same thing? Well, there may be. Alignment. The one I threw out here is, well, what happens if we do the opposite? Because people will say to me time and time again, well, you know, if I don't do this, I'm not going to survive. And I go, let's explore this. Okay, suppose you quit your job and you go and do this. What happens? Well, after 6 months, I run out of money. Okay, then what happens? Well, then I come back out of the mountains and I start talking with people, I guess, and just take it through. And strangely enough, they're going to survive this. It's a somewhat unpredictable path, but they're not going to die. And most of us in this culture and in the circumstance that we're talking about, these aren't things that are actually going to kill us. They may lead to very drastic changes in our life, but that's what you're here for anyway, so I'm not worrying about that. So the idea that you have to do this because it's the only way you know how to survive, that's not true. You will survive, just in a very different way. What's the big picture? That's to get out of the reduction, okay? You know, so rather than reduce it all to one emotionally charged issue, let's take a look at the whole thing. It's different, and in which that emotional charge is simply one element. It brings a sense of perspective. And then the last one, what happens if we include both polarities? That's putting the two together. Get a lot of really good creative stuff happening there. But you may come up with other questions. I just was giving you those six ways of eliminating creativity or killing creativity. And just explore this, see what you come up with. I'm always open to new questions. I met a psychiatrist recently who comes up with the most amazing questions. They're just brilliant. Here's one for you. What is something you ignored that has been a hassle in your life ever since? So, what is something that you didn't pay attention to that you wish you had now because it's been a hassle in your life ever since? You know, and that just, oh, wow, yeah, there's a few things I could think of, etc. So anyway, so what I want you to do now is divide up into groups. And take one or two, the first step is to look at what's the genesis, what are the conditions that prevent you from making what you want to happen happen. And the other two people are, once you've told them that, are going to ask you some of these questions with the objective to clarifying and deepening your own understanding of what the genesis and conditions are. Okay? Yes.
Is this what are the conditions that allow our barriers to flourish?
Yes.
Okay.
Because you remove the barriers, then other things will happen quite naturally. Carol, microphone.
So I'm trying to relate willingness to Genesis, or is there a relationship there?
Well, what's your problem in willingness?
Fear.
Okay. What's the genesis of the fear?
Know how.
No, maybe. But that's the question. What is the genesis of the fear? And what are the conditions in your life that allows that fear to continue to grow and operate in you? And a lot of that's going to be internal. In a few cases, it may be external. To give you an example, we often have very, very deep seated beliefs that if I do X, then Y will happen. And people may have explained to us This is simply not the case. I am thinking of one person who never made demands on people, never asked them for anything, because if he felt that if he asked them for anything, it would lead to the dissolution of the relationship. So it made it very difficult for him to supervise people. It made it very difficult for him to have satisfactory relationships of any kind, because he was always giving and getting nothing in return. It's very imbalanced. So I said, okay, this is what you believe. We've talked about it, and you agree with me that it isn't true, but it's still operating with you. So listening to me is not enough. I want you to scientifically test this belief. I want you to make a small request of someone every day. And so he started to do this. And he was astounded that the people he was supervising were delighted to be asked to do something. Gave them something to do in their work. And his relationships, people were just responded so positively, he had no idea. And so through his own experience, he came to understand that his belief was wrong. But that belief was the genesis for that problem. And that's why I'm encouraging you to take a look. What's the genesis for the fear? And we may say, well, it's X, Y, but I want you to, way back, my mother hung spiders when I was in my playpen or something like that. But what gives rise to it now? What does it come from now? That's what you want to look at. So keep it in the present. There's a question over here. Yes. Microphone, please.
I think I'm getting clearer. I was wondering if you could just very briefly walk us through one of, like, anger. What's the hypothetical anger? And then what are the conditions, just to kind of concretize it a little bit more for me?
Okay. That's a very good idea. Okay, well, I'll take something from my own experience. Writing a book. The people had started asking me or suggesting that I should write something as far back as the late 80s. And in 1993, I went to Santa Fe and rented an apartment for a month with the sole purpose of writing a book on meditation. It didn't happen. I delivered a series of lectures on basic meditation and had transcribed all of those lectures. So what did writing consist of? Just editing a bunch of transcripts. It didn't happen. But that 1 month in Santa Fe did help me to understand the genesis. I didn't want to write that book at all. I had absolutely no interest in writing another book on basic meditation. And it just looked at no. I did a lot of other things in Santa Fe, but that I didn't do. And I got really clear about that. So now I knew what the problem was. I didn't know the book that I wanted to write. And so that was very helpful. So when anybody said, well, when are you going to write something? I'd go, I don't know, because I didn't know what I wanted to write. Then a condition came about. One of my students said, Ken, it would be really helpful if you would just sketch out the big picture of how you're teaching us. Just what does Buddhism look like? Because I would help people with individual things, but I'd never give them the whole context. And stupidly, because I understood the whole context. I figured they would, but they hadn't done 3-year retreat or anything like that, so they didn't know. Can't understand the stupidity of people, but that's how it is. I mean, that's the kind of ignorance that was operating in me. So I put something together, and people liked that. And that actually became one of the chapters. And so there was a bit of positive feedback from that. That was a condition. And then there was a bit more and a bit more. So through this, I began to get the a sense of what was the book I would actually like to write. So as long not knowing what the kind of book I wanted to write or was interested in writing, that was the genesis of my inability to write. And there are all kinds of conditions that went into that. Do you follow? Okay. Other questions before I go on? Paige.
This is just to clarify something in my mind, because you mentioned karma was not the common cause and effect. Are you saying it's this genesis and
absolutely
conditions?
Thank you for bringing that up. That's absolutely right. The Tibetan phrase consists of three words, le, ju, dre. Le is the word for karma itself, action. Ju is the word that is usually translated as cause or seed, but I'm translating as genesis. And dre is the word for fruit or result. And so it is action, genesis, result. And what determines whether a particular genesis matures into a result are conditions. So, for instance, going back to your question, the genesis could be fear of something. The condition could be hanging around with people who all share the same fear. So they keep reinforcing you. It's very interesting when you hang around people who don't have that particular fear. You say, well, I don't know how to do that. I don't know whether I could do that. I'm too afraid to do that. You're afraid to do that? Come on, we're going to do this right now. And then you find you can do it. So that's another example of separating the genesis from the conditions. Okay? Yes?
So we find that we're with people that, like, help continue the conditions. So, mm-hmm. like, in the tradition that I've been studying, they talk about that all the people that we're with at any given time that were karmically interconnected in similar conditions. So that's what we're trying to work out is like, changing that. So if we're with all these people that are holding us back, our work is to karmically purify and move on and change? I mean, does that make sense?
Like, I think that's a wonderful myth.
It's a myth? Okay.
It's simply a way of looking at things. It's a way of interpreting things.
Okay.
There's no way to know at all.
Right.
It's simply a way of interpreting things. That can be helpful to people. It can also be very, very problematic for people, because it will take, again, it can be a way of killing their idea. Like, I don't want to hang out here. And somebody will say, well, you need to hang out here because you've got to work something out. I love the Maori proverb, don't hang out with people who don't respect you.
Well, isn't it a way too, though, for like seeing? Like, isn't that like the mirror seeing? Like, if you can snap to it and realize that these other people have these things going on, and then all of a sudden realizing, well, I must too, yeah, because I'm in this situation. So now I need a way of seeing it to fix it. No.
This is what you're describing there, and I completely agree with you. Is making use of the situation. To say that the situation has come together in order to teach you that's what I regard as a myth.
Right.
You may choose to make use of it, no argument there. But the idea that you're in this situation in order to learn something and this is your fate, that's something that I regard
as... I was talking about it being a karmic mirror type thing, and noticing, like they say that if the same accidents keep happening to you, that you need to start recognizing these patterns and that you might want to start fixing them because they're going to keep happening and happening and happening until you fix them.
But what you're describing here is not an existential thing. It is how you are approaching it.
Okay.
And that's the distinction that I want to make. If you're approaching in that way out of your own volition, not a problem. But I've heard exactly the same kind of reasoning being used to keep people in situations that are not harmful, that are not helpful for them.
Okay.
And that's why I wanted to make the distinction. But if your attitude to a situation is, what can I learn here? What is this telling me about myself? That's great. Yeah. There was another question somewhere other. Okay. So yes.
I think that I may have gotten a little bit lost somewhere. Were you saying, and granted, I know that maybe you're not saying that we actually have to have these three steps exactly, but are you saying, like, in terms of the Tibetan interpretation of there being karma, then seed / genesis, then result, would then be rephrased as action, genesis, and result? Is that what you said? Or I think I might be confused between, I understand the difference between genesis and condition as you're talking about it, but I might also have some confusion.
Okay.
Okay, I think.
In response to Paige's question, because he was asking, when you're talking about genesis condition, are you talking about karma as cause and effect? And I said, which is the usual terminology, and I said yes. And then I went on to explain that the term for karma, the full long word for karma in Tibetan, is action, because that's what karma means. Karma actually means action. Action, genesis, result. And that's how you form words in Tibetan, is you put other words together. But the whole thing is based on the principle that there is a something which starts growing into things if the conditions are right. If the conditions aren't right, it doesn't. So, but you have to have the something to grow, and you have to have the conditions. Without both of those, nothing happens. Does that clarify? Great. Okay. So to review the exercise, we need to get started now. You're going to take one of the things that gets in your way that you identified in the previous exercise. Don't have time to work through all of them. Maybe you have time to work through a couple. I don't know. And to the best of your ability, identify the genesis and the conditions that contribute to this, to what gets in your way. The other two people, by asking creative questions, which hopefully will take you totally out of your comfort zone, because that's the point of them, to get clear about genesis conditions, because a lot of people confuse. They think a condition is a genesis or a genesis is a condition and things like that. So getting, and the point here is to get as clear as you can so that you have something very concrete to work on in your life that's going to help you to be able to make things happen. Okay? Is that clear? And we'll do the same triads. We need to, because of the number of people here, there is one group that's a pair. Rather than have four people in two groups, there's one group which has two people. So if you end up with just one other, there's only one of those. So if you end up with that person, that's just recognize that. And so divide up into groups, and we'll do it. We'll do 2 minutes, 2 minutes, 2 minutes. So we'll have about half an hour, and then we'll break for lunch. Chuck, do you want to bring those people in the hall in, please? Okay. Let's hear some of your experiences with this exercise, because it seemed to go a little deeper, as was intended. Anybody like to volunteer? If not, I'll just volunteer people. But where are the microphones? Okay, can you look around and see? Can you? Okay, it's the microphone here. Oh, you got one, Kim? Good, go ahead.
I'm feeling elated. I feel that I have found the answer.
Would you like to share it with us?
Well, it's very complicated, and it's a long kind of
experience. Well, let's talk about your experience. What happened? What was your experience of finding the answer? Not just what was that experience like?
Well, first, I brought up all the obstacles that were in my way.
I just want you to describe the experience. What happened in your body? How did you know you had found the answer?
What I was looking for is a stronger heartbeat, which I'm feeling now.
Good.
So I feel freed.
So you feel lighter in your body?
Uh-huh.
Okay. What else?
I experience a sense of freedom.
How do you experience that physically?
Feeling light.
Okay. Anything else? Do you feel tense, relaxed?
Totally relaxed.
Totally relaxed.
And not at all, shy or
okay.
I used to be.
Emotionally, what is your experience?
I'm feeling emotionally open.
Emotionally open. And in terms of your mind or awareness or your intellect, what's that like?
I am in clear mind.
Clear mind.
And feeling secure. In other words, confident.
Confident, okay. Mm-hmm. So that's very helpful. Thank you. So these are, notice the experiences here. Relaxed, free from tension, lighter body. Emotionally open and confident and clear in one's mind. How does that, that feels pretty good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's when something is open and we come to know that's what we experience. Even when it is quite painful or difficult, we will still have those same experiences. That it indicates that you've joined with the situation and there's a seeing or a knowing that has arisen. This knowing is not intellectual. It is direct knowing. And this is how it manifests in body, in emotions, and in the mind. So thank you, Kim. Okay, anybody else? Kathy.
I felt squirmy and uncomfortable.
Okay. And did you ignore these feelings, or do you ordinarily ignore these feelings?
I don't think I ignored them, though I felt like I wanted to kind of move on to another topic or
absolutely
wiggle away. And I'm sure in the past I have avoided them.
Okay. Did you find it fruitful to open to those feelings?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Good. That's a very, very good example. Thank you. So squirmy and uncomfortable. Can anybody else resonate with that? Okay. You want to say a word about that, Nigar? He's so, also getting a little hot there.
Like, so I've been cold this whole time, but I was sweating bullets over there. And what was interesting is that intellectually, I hadn't entirely bought into what I was even talking about, but physically, I was all over it. So I'm still doing the mind-body thing, but I've hit on something. I'm not entirely sure what.
Okay.
And I sweat a lot, so sorry. Okay.
So when I said at the beginning of our session today, this is about direct experience. You pay attention to what's arising in the body, what's arising emotionally, not just the stories that are playing in the head. Because when we're just working with the stories in our head, we're working with, at best, 1/3 of the information that we that's available. When we open to our body, when we open to our emotions, we start including the other 2/3. There's a tremendous amount of very valuable information there. It's also where there's a lot of knowing in both of those areas that many of us habitually ignore for all kinds of reasons. Okay. Carolyn?
Almost unclothed state here about the the layers.
You're feeling naked.
Yeah, I felt very vulnerable.
Okay.
And it was explosive. I mean, my heart opened, my eye. I mean, thank goodness you said to stay there because I was about to jump ship on that, the emotional part of it. But it touched very deeply, and it opened me up very widely. Still pretty clammy, but very core. I mean, it just got to the real center of the it. I mean, I'm still trying to. It was just.
You may not have it in words, but you can feel it.
Oh yeah.
Okay. This is another thing that can happen here. You may not have it in words, but you actually feel it. That's experiencing it. That's all that's necessary. Now, it may not be sufficient to experience it just once. It may take a while in order to experience it completely. But now you're working with the genesis of something. And the reason it's a genesis is because it hasn't been experienced, and we developed all of these strategies to avoid precisely that feeling. That is, when we develop the capacity to experience it, and the know-how, because there's a certain skill, and that's basically what I was giving you at that point, was saying, okay, do it, and I know you have the capacity. Right. But I said, okay, no, this is where you do, you stay, and that's part of the know-how. And you are willing to do that, then you move into experiencing what has been getting in the way. And when we experience something completely, what happens to it? It releases. That's the nature of complete experience. That's what all of the direct awareness traditions in Buddhism are about, experiencing things completely so that they don't leave residue. In Zen mind, beginner's mind, for instance, Suzuki Roshi talks about experiencing something completely so that there aren't even ashes left. Okay. Anything you want to add, Carolyn?
This isn't an unfamiliar kind of thing. When I get on this, that's why I try to avoid retreats like the plague. But I knew,
Why?
I know. But of course, it's really hard to articulate around this about how to use that experience I guess, like you say, it's just there, and it will have manifested in whatever way it's going to.
At this point, and generally speaking, don't try to use the experience. Just experience it, because it represents, it is part of us that we don't normally experience, and it's not being able to experience, not experiencing it, that introduces imbalance. So it isn't the case that we have to use it or figure out some way to do with it. Even when we're formulating that, we're already removing ourselves from it in some extent. Just open to the experience and become familiar with it so you begin to recognize it whenever it arises and you don't fear it. And thus you keep including it in experience, in experience, in experience until it no longer runs your life. Okay? So you don't actually have to use it or understand it or figure out what to do with it other than that. This is about experiencing your life completely. What gets in the way of our ability to make things happen is that when we start trying to make something happen, something arises in us, and so we can't experience things completely. And that introduces an imbalance, and we go off the rails. We get blocked inside, or something takes over and starts running us in another direction. But by constantly opening fully to the experience, whatever it is, then we're in the world of experience and we know more, we will know much more clearly what to do and how to do it. But you don't, but don't think of it in terms of using it, just experience it. Okay? A couple of more comments if anybody has them. Yes. Can we have a microphone down here, please?
Lighthearted and tender.
Very nice. Good. Anybody else?
It was quite revealing because I had been thinking of fear of failure as creating a barrier between myself and my goal. And what they, other people in my group pointed out to me was that I'm actually going ahead with it. So it's not a barrier. That, and, you know, which was kind of like, you're right. No, but I had, risk-taking has been that thing, that little thing that I've ignored, that little big thing that I've ignored. And so I think the feeling around that, you know, is a big pattern. And perhaps working on increasing the capacity to hold that. And at the same time, in my particular case, developing, you know, complementing my weaknesses with other people's strengths that are interested in the project. And you know, so it was also suggested that I do focus groups. And I do, it's definitely my goal that this be their project, that this be serve their needs, mm-hmm. and that their ideas are central in it as well. And so, you know, I think I can do that.
Great. Very good. Very good. Okay. We're almost quarter to one. We're going to take a break now for lunch. The focus this morning has been setting a framework. I want to introduce the willingness, capacity, know-how framework so that you can see it's kind of a map into what gets in our way. And it's also it's a useful map because it helps us to clarify what efforts to make in specific areas. And then the second part of this morning, how to go more deeply into experiencing what actually gets in our way. Because it's by experiencing what gets in our way that and being able to experience it that it ceases to get in our way. It may not go away, but it ceases to get in our way. And that's an important distinction. You know the old adage, feel the fear and do it anyway. But you have to have the capacity or know how to feel the fear, and then you can do it anyway. It's not necessarily that you get rid of fear. You talk to theatrical actors and actresses, they almost universally say, if you aren't scared out of your skin before you go on stage, you're probably not going to have a good performance. So it's not that they don't have fear. They do have fear, and they do it. So this afternoon, we're going to focus on the process by which we actually make things happen. The first step is to give you some tools and ways of getting working with the stuff that prevents you from making things happen. This afternoon, we're going to focus on how to make things actually happen. Quite a bit of material. Let's meet back here so that we're ready to go right at 2.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.